This is Right On, a series of conversations with Minnesota authors, historians, and filmmakers. Right On is supported by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Hello and welcome to Right On. I'm Glenn Broggett. Today we are going to take a trip back to those childhood days for a lot of our listeners with our special guest, Kate Roberts. Kate is co-author, along with Adam Scher, of Toys of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, published by Minnesota Historical Society Press. The book not only covers some of the most iconic toys of all time, but also discusses how they were created, their cultural legacy, and also the stories of the kids who played with them way back when, who eventually became adults who either bought them for their children and grandchildren, or maybe just started collecting them altogether. It's author Kate Roberts, author of Toys of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, on this edition of Right On.
Thank you very much for having me tonight, and thanks to Pioneer 90.1 for inviting me here to Thief River Falls. What I've done tonight is I've kind of structured my talk around some frequently asked questions, things that people ask me about this book. So, and what I'd like to do is kind of do that, but then also have time at the end to answer some questions to it, to talk a little, just have a conversation. So the first thing that people usually say is, why a book about toys of the baby boomer era? Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, we had done a pretty successful book and exhibit several years ago on 1968, and we knew that people were really interested in the post-war sort of baby boom era going into the 60s and 70s. So we tested a lot of other topics, and toys topped the list, along with the Vietnam War. There was also great interest in that. There was interest in forgotten fads of the era. But toys really topped the list. This is also something that is part of our mission at the Historical Society. We have a number of strategic priorities, and one of them is in cultivating meaningful relationships with adult audiences, which are people who very much would have played with toys of this era. But the other thing, though, that we really started to feel more and more strongly as we went along was that toys really do reflect their times. And if you think back to what you played with as a kid, what you might remember, and start drawing some parallels between what was going on during the time, you start to think, yeah, they really do reflect. And today, the same way, they reflect what's going on in the period. We started thinking about how should we structure this book. And what came to us more and more was that we wanted it to be a book, and I mentioned that there's an accompanying exhibit too, that would really get people talking, because storytelling and sort of linking to personal history, we know that that's a great way to get people thinking about larger topics in history. So that's how we structured the book. More about that in a minute, but I want to start and tell you that the other thing that we became convinced of was that just like there was a baby boom in the post-war years, there was a toy boom too. There really honestly was. All sorts of toys were introduced. We've got a couple of them here tonight, but you know, you start thinking about the classic toys that we know today, and a lot of them really did come about in the post-war period. So this toy boom that we're talking about, these are some lead soldiers made during World War I. You know, people have always had toys. Right? But for most of history, they were homemade. They were made people with found materials, or say in the 18th century, you could buy a handmade china head for a doll, and then you'd make the rest of the doll body at home. Homemade toys. Homemade toys. But then you think about the Industrial Revolution, right? In the 19th century, we've got all sorts of factors going on. We've got the possibility of doing all sorts of things, like lead soldiers, which you could now make by the hundreds and hundreds, first in Europe, then in the U.S. By the end of the 19th century, so we've really got the capability of making toys mass-produced. Also, now that's a Christmas window display from Dayton's in the 50s, but think what else happens in the early 20th century and leading into the post-war era. You've got mail-order catalogs, Sears, Montgomery Wards, got the availability of a lot of these goods. that you didn't have earlier. And you've got department stores. You know, Dayton's is a good example, but across the country, Wanamaker's in Philadelphia, Macy's, Gimbel's, and in the years following the war, the 50s and 60s, the idea of the Christmas display, of course, becomes huge. And maybe some of us remember that, going downtown to look at the Christmas windows, which of course are filled with toys. The wide availability of certain materials, particularly plastics. Plastics certainly were around long before the 1950s. But in terms of affordability, in terms of making a material that's something that you can really use for a reasonable amount of money to produce some reasonably priced toys, that becomes huge in the 1950s and 60s. And I don't know if anybody remembers this. I had a Block City set. This is sort of a Lego-like set, a building set. Do you guys remember this at all? Block City? Yeah. There were a number of plastic building sets, of course, but plastic for dolls, plastic for any kinds of figurines, plastic for you name it, became available. And then, of course, we can't forget the importance of TV. 1 million sets were in use in the U.S. in 1949, and there were 50 million a decade later. And you think about that, you think about the rise in the use of TVs and what that means for advertising, what that means for children coming in direct contact with toys that they then go to their folks to buy thanks to Saturday morning cartoons as well as advertisements. You really can't underestimate the importance of television in terms of fueling this interest in toys. And it's not just the ads, of course. The other thing that I think we forget about today is that product placement was alive and well on a lot of these kids' shows in the 50s. That's Miss Frances from Ding Dong School and, of course, Captain Kangaroo. And there wasn't the concern in the early days of television. I mean, they would seamlessly go from doing a spelling lesson, a math lesson, to promoting a toy. Talking about, kids, you can get this. This can be yours. And then back to Mr. Green Jeans and the rest of the show. There weren't the regulations. So children's television definitely sparked the popularity of all sorts of toys. We've got this full-fledged toy boom going on. So how did we organize the book? What did we do to fit? Well, we thought about a bunch of different stuff. And initially we thought, let's do it thematically. And you can imagine how this would work, right? The chapter on toys, on dolls, and how dolls have changed over time. So you start from the baby dolls of the 50s, and then you go into the 60s with Barbie, but then also the other dolls that were popular in the period. All those little small little kiddles and the different little things, and not to mention the trolls, of course. And then the 70s, you know, with basically amplified themes from the earlier eras. Like one toy that we have in the book is Baby Brother Tender Love. In the 1970s, there's a baby boy doll, which new, right? Another theme could be science toys. And again, think about that. If you think in the 50s, science fiction toys, the stun guns and the ray guns and all the toys that are fueled by the Ray Bradbury and Isaac Asimov era. The science kits, the chemistry kits. We've all heard about remember the chemistry kits in the 50s. Okay, then you take that into the 60s. Well, you've still, of course, got science fiction going, and you've got robots, and increasingly the robots are made in Japan, right? And they're tin robots that are imported from Japan. You've also got astronauts becoming folk heroes, and NASA toys get hugely popular. So there's another spin on science toys. Move to the 70s, you've still got all of that going on. But what else happens? In 1977, Star Wars comes out and ushers in a whole different way of thinking about science fiction. And I'll show you in a little bit, too. There's an interesting spin on the chemistry set. They're because the environment becomes a concern. And I'll show you in a little bit a 1970s environmental toy. You can see those themes could have worked pretty well. We also thought, what if we just do open with a department store window and then kind of take that apart almost in a chronological way? Well, what we ended up doing, and you'll see if you take a look at the book, we sort of did a little bit of a blend of those. I want to just back up just a minute and show you that this is how the exhibit is organized. So the exhibit has three living rooms, a 50 room, a 60s, and a 70s room, with theme cases around it. So out of that basic organization, we picked 15 toys from each decade. That was a really hard choice, as you can imagine. There are about 450 toys in the exhibit. So think about, we picked 45 that we thought would allow us to really explore some interesting themes of the era. One thing that we were pretty mindful of all the way through as we were writing this book was, what can we do that's a little different? As you know, and you know, again, we were talking about this, there is no shortage of interest in baby boomer toys, and there's no shortage of books out there about toys. These are three that we actually relied on for some of our research. They're very well done, and they have a lot of great information. Timeless Toys, Toy Time, and Baby Boomer Toys by Mark Rich. We thought, we can do something different here. What we can do that really hasn't been done before is ask people for their stories, ask people for their memories. So we had a pretty successful campaign online where we really did ask people to share with us their memories of toys that they had, toys that they wanted, what toys meant to them. And we got some pretty great responses. And I think that's what then ended up really shaping our book, was the thought that we can really take the individual stories and use them as springboards to talk about the greater culture. And it's kind of fun because the toy stories started to sort themselves a little bit into categories. There was the wish I had that category, of course. All the things that people see that they say, oh, if only I had had that. And here's an example of a great story, I think, by Terry Scheller, who was born in 1959. She says, this, and she means Mousetrap here, the game Mousetrap, this along with Operation and the John and Jane West dolls, with their horses and all their tack, were part of a suite of toys that never, ever made it into my house. Too many parts to lose, too expensive, and frankly, too cool for my parents to even think of buying. We got Puzzle, Sorry, and the game that came the closest, Clue. But oh, how I dreamed of the day that this would be in our house. If they had gotten it for me, I would have become an engineer, I'm sure. So, and I think, you know, I swear, for every time that I've heard I had that, I hear I wanted that. No, it's just as strong today, and it's amazing how we carry those things with us. Another category, of course, it made me what I am today. And this is something that we specifically ask people to think about. Can you see some relationship between the toys you had as a kid or the toys you wanted as a kid and where you are today? Sometimes people could make those links, sometimes not. It took me personally a long time because I was thinking, nah, not me. And then the more I thought about it, I thought, you know, one of my favorite toys was the ViewMaster. I loved that ViewMaster. This is the, of course, the slide. You could look at the slides and see them in 3D. Well, I grew up to be an art historian by training. So when you think about it, yeah, probably. You know, I was looking at these slides over and over of the wonders of the world or of famous paintings or of Venice by moonlight or whatever. I mean, you know that there were hundreds and hundreds of these reels available. And I bet it did at some level shape me. Or it was a predilection that showed itself off really early. Well, this, you guys might, anybody remember Robot Commando? I've been surprised. We haven't had this is a highly collectible toy today. It was made by Marvin Glass and Associates, which also incidentally made Mousetrap, Operation, Mr. Machine, if you remember that one. Tons of toys from this single company. Anyway, this is Robot Commando. And this is Jim Ekberg, who's today a marketing communications consultant, talking about his relation to this toy. If you wanted to point to one thing in my life that sparked a lasting interest in mechanics and engineering, this is it. When you opened that plastic skull, you had direct access to all the gears, cams, pulleys, rods, and wires within. I must have ripped off half the skin on my hands trying to reach in and examine how all that apparatus worked, and eventually I broke it. My mother was mad, but my father and I took it as an opportunity for applied screwdrivers and hex wrenches. Marvelous time with old dad, but the surgery was not successful. From then on, I supplied the motion and the noise to the toy myself. And then the third category, which I think we were talking about a little bit, I can't believe we played with that kind of thing. And you might probably know this, you might remember this, some of you, that regulations really came in the late 60s. That was when the first sort of toy protection acts under President Nixon were really signed. But certainly before that, there was a concern about toy safety. This is, of course, the somewhat infamous Jarts game that some of us might remember. Now, you know, and people were all over the map with this. Jarts, of course, are basically, you know, lawn darts. Some parents were fine with just standing back and letting what would happen happen. Some people said, this is not meant for kids in the first place. In fact, the early boxes for this game had no warnings at all, but they did imply that it was meant for adults. And then very quickly, the company started putting more and more warnings on, saying this is for adults or with supervision, et cetera, et cetera. But Jarts, I have an example here tonight of the clackers or bolo balls, which were infamous for the, you know, you could take an eye out with those things, these hard balls that you whip around in the air. Super balls were another one. I'm trying to think. I mean, we can think of them. Cap pistols. There are many, many things that probably wouldn't pass muster today. I mentioned those chemistry sets. Some of those had some fairly suspicious substances in them. Here's something from Lisa Crawford Anderson about Jarts. This was a fun family game we played in the backyard. Eventually, we took our Jarts up to the cabin where they still live. My parents were always telling us, stand back. You never knew where the crazy kids were going to throw the soaring missiles, especially if you wanted to scare one of your little siblings. And I can attest to that, being the youngest in my family, I certainly had my share of, you know, fakes of the Jarts being pointed at me. So, where to get the toys? Another question that people often want to ask. Well, of course, we have a lot of toys in our collections. It hasn't been a collecting priority of ours. But certainly as household collections have come in or as we've looked for particular things, we have amassed many, including a lot of Minnesota-based toys. And this is a good example, Lacoutey, which I think most of us remember, they're still in production today, was invented by a Minneapolis man and was first sold on consignment at Dayton's. So Herb Shopper and Shopper Toys went on to do Don't Break the Ice, Ants in the Pants, lots of other toys as well. But this was the one that put him on the map. We have Cooties in our collection and other Minnesota toys. Here's another one you might recognize, of course. Can't forget that Tonka is a Minnesota-based company. The story behind Tonka is pretty interesting, and some of you, again, may know this, that they started out in 1946, right after the war, doing lawn equipment, metal lawn equipment, but they also then started doing just a couple of toys, just a couple of trucks in those early years, and the trucks are what sold. So, of course, over time, this became a huge toy company. The thing that sometimes surprises people is that of all the Minnesota companies, oh, we were talking earlier about Gumby and Pokey, too, made by Lakeside Industries in Minneapolis. So there's another one that, of course, the character was not invented in Minnesota, but the toy itself was perfected, the one with the bendy toy. But people don't realize that 3M made a line of toys either. And we've got Quinto here today. There was another pretty popular one named Trice. They were called bookshelf toys. And they were, you know, a tasteful set of toys. 3M didn't have toy inventors on staff. They invited proposals from people and put out a lot of toys, which we have quite a few in our collection of those too. It's kind of that's an interesting topic. We were talking earlier about how much more information is now available on the internet, and there's some great stuff out of there just coming to light now about 3M games, which have been kind of overlooked. We also have some other things in our collection, not just toys, of course, but the ephemera that goes with them. Ads, for example. We have a lot of Tonka trade catalogs. So this is kind of interesting. As I mentioned, the Herb Shopper is the person who invented Cootie. We have this photo in our collection. And when we started out looking into the photos that we had in the collection, this is a photo of a man playing with Cootie with two young children. And that's how it was described in our photo catalog. Well, we started wondering if this might be Mr. Shopper, and eventually we tracked down one of his stepdaughters to verify that this was, in fact, him. So we were able to identify him and add to our knowledge for our photo catalog, which was kind of fun. Now, the other thing that we did, we got very lucky and were able to work with some great private and institutional lenders to put together some toys that are featured in the book. This is Gary Hoffmeister from Mankato. And he had written to us, he had been at the History Center more than a year ago for another exhibit. And he had visited and heard that we were putting together a toy exhibit. So he wrote to us and said, one of the staff mentioned that there will be a display of vintage toys set up. If you're interested in vintage model kits, I do have a nice collection, including boxes, factory-built store displays. Well, it turns out that Gary has a fabulous collection of Revell model kits. Remember the little plastic models from the 50s and 60s? But the other thing that really intrigued us was that he attached a couple of photos of himself to his initial message to us. And in the first photo, his dad is building a model kit, and Gary is on the left watching. 30 years later, Gary staged that photo again with himself building the model kit and his daughter watching. And I was so taken by this sort of generational look at the photos that I was dying to meet him. And of course, we ended up then borrowing a number of his toys. Here's the one we featured in the book. This is the Sikorsky rescue helicopter. And it's a testament to just how beautiful those Revell kits were in the 50s and 60s. This is finely detailed, a little bit pricier than some of the others that were on the market during the time, and absolutely researched for accuracy. Revell prided itself on modeling their toys on actual full-size, full-scale airplanes, cars, etc. Another private lender that was kind of fun. You can see here we have a Matchbox toys and a little Tammy doll. This is a woman named Jane Leonard, who had been the director for the state's sesquicentennial celebration. So I had met her a little bit during that, but I didn't really know her. But I got an email from my boss one day that just said, I had a fun lunch with Jane Leonard. She has some great toys. Here's a few photos. She'd be very open to working with us. So I pursued it, and it turned out that Jane, really, here's Jane today, and there she is with her twin sister, posing with Lassie, incidentally. Turns out that Jane didn't have just a few toys. Jane has a fabulous collection of Matchbox toys. We're talking like dozens and dozens of them. And what was fun about her collection, as you can see, is that it's in beautiful condition. And she was generous enough to let us use as many of them as we wanted for the photo shoot for the exhibit, or for the book and then for the exhibit. She wrote, I began collecting Matchbox cars when I was probably 6 or 7. purchasing a box when my mom took my twin sister and me shopping with her at a big department store. At the time, the cars cost 44 cents, which I could pay for out of a weekly allowance of 50 cents. I loved the boxes. I loved how sturdy and realistic the cars and trucks were. And what's interesting about her is she never played with these. She was a collector from the time she was a little girl. So the boxes are intact. She kept everything just as it was. And she just, as she mentioned, she loved the detail of it all. And she kept it as a collection till today. And finally, we talked about this earlier, you cannot discount the importance of online purchasing these days. Having eBay available to us in writing this book turned out to be a fairly valuable resource. And the reason I say that is because I mentioned earlier that we were collecting stories all along, right? So sometimes we get stories from people. We think, well, this is great. This is really interesting, but we don't have the toy. And we were very lucky in some cases to be able to match up what we were reading about with what was available on eBay. Here's just a couple of examples. This is a doll called Poor Pitiful Pearl. Does anybody remember this? Every once in a while, a person will come into the gallery and, yes, yes, I had that, or I wanted that. This is a doll that was came out of a storybook by William Steig, who is better known today for the Shrek character, if you know the Shrek movies. He was a cartoonist for the New Yorker. And he invented this character, Poor Pitiful Pearl. And the idea was that she was sold with two outfits. She came with a little kerchief and a patch dress, and then she also came with a party dress and polished shoes. And the idea was that the little girl could dress her up or down. And I loved this from Annie Stanfield, who wrote this and made me really want to find this doll. It wasn't that I was particularly pitiful, but there was no way I could identify with glamour dolls. Pearl helped me accept that most of us were made up of both our black shoe and bandana times, as well as the possibility of shining. She was a plain doll with a wry, knowing smile, and a true friend to a little tomboy with scabby knees and a wish not to have to wear high heels. I love that. And, you know, you remember, too, she's coming out. Barbie is introduced in 1959. So more and more, little girls are, of course, being introduced to that world of dolls. So Poor Pitiful Pearl is a really interesting one from that era. We were able to find her intact with her box on eBay, which was great for us because it really allowed us to feature this story. Here's another one, which I have today, the Spell It, which was an early form of computer. I loved this story. When I look back, this was an early form of computer. In the early days of no TV or very little TV, games like this were my indoor entertainment. Well, in this case, Cindy Clark is kind of doing our work for us when she's telling this story. She's reminding us that there was a time before TV, there was a time before electronic games, there was a link to these early games, and we had another one that we played with called Quizziac, which was similar. It was called the game with a brain, and it was basically just a funny little cardboard quiz toy. But they do, in some cases, presage what happens with electronic toys in the late 70s. So it was fun to get these stories and then be able to match them up. Just one more, and this was a particularly interesting one. This is a Sara Lee doll. Sara Lee was made just for 2 years in the early 50s, and she was the conception of a woman named Sara Lee Preach, who lived in Florida, and who really wanted there to be, there had been African-American dolls, of course, for decades before this, but Ms. Creech really wanted a doll that was patterned on African-American children and features. She hired a sculptor to work on these features, to model them on actual children. And again, I was fascinated by this. I had read about this doll. We tried to borrow one from a number of institutions, but it's a fairly scarce thing. And one appeared on eBay one day. So we were able to get this in very good condition. Finally, I mentioned about that chemistry set, the environmental test kit. And this is one of my favorite toys in the exhibit, the Johnny Horizon environmental test kit from 1971. The U.S. Department of the Interior had invented this character, Johnny Horizon, sort of on the order of Smokey Bear, but Johnny Horizon was the spokesperson for the environment. And they had a campaign going. You can see Burl Ives was released a record with songs about the environment. This came out just right around the first Earth Day, which was 1970, of course. And then Parker Brothers, in conjunction with the U.S. Department of the Interior, put together this toy environmental test kit, which is sort of an interesting spin on those earlier chemistry kits of the 50s and 60s. Here you test the pH in your water, or you test the air quality in your neighborhood. And I just love this, and we looked for it everywhere. Once, and again, we finally found one, and this one, we were talking about this. This was mint in its box, never open. And again, maybe that's a testament to how interesting the toy was. But nonetheless, we were very happy to find it. So what didn't make it into the book? Well, I think we both, Adam and I, both probably wish that we could have done more with board games. So popular all the way through this era, and so many of us have so many great memories. But we kind of said, let's limit ourselves to one per decade, just so we can make sure we get in the full range of toys. But you can imagine just how many other toys. You think about something like Yahtzee, for example, Clue, Masterpiece. I mean, there are Battleship. There are so many. You could do this book just with the board games, and again, do a really interesting parallel with what's going on in society. I think of the James Bond and 007 toys of the, or games of the mid-60s with the Cold War raging, or I think of, you know, various other things that really do reflect their times. Or outdoor toys. Again, we were able to include a few in the exhibit, or in the book, I should say. The Whammo story, I think, we did include a Whammo Frisbee, but the whole idea of all of these toys, the Whammo company developed Slip and Slide and the Water Wheel, and if you want to talk about lawsuits just waiting to happen, we talked about some of the more questionable toys in terms of safety. I think Whammo really sort of cornered the market there. I think we would have liked to have included a few more of these sort of outdoor things, just to sort of balance. And then finally, we were able to sneak in the whole idea of imagination. And in a way, you know, maybe that's another book. But one of the things that we really talked about back and forth all along was, well, toys are very important, of course. Material culture is very important. But what about what kids do with the toys? What about the ways that they play in ways that would never have been intended by the toy maker? What about all the times where the kids prefer the box to the actual toy? And we got a great story that I just want to read to you here in closing. This is from Rose Sherman, who was born in 1958, who said, "Sure, we received a toy or two on our birthdays and at Christmas. We had toys, but one of our favorite games, Town, was played with none of them. We played town in our basement with a half dozen or more kids from our family in the neighborhood. We had a town store called Most's after the nearby grocer. Most sold eggs, which were actually empty egg cartons, and canned goods and homemade pickled food from our cellar. We had a school, a restaurant, and a saloon with empty Grain Belt bottles and a bottle of Canadian Club. We paid for our food and drink with Monopoly money. And we had a police station with a sheriff who arrested the boys who left the saloon without paying for their drinks." So I think that's a great reminder, and we did sort of include a reminder in the book that the power of imagination and the way, and again, power of imagination and the way that we play with toys and the people who play with us are really what makes this subject come alive. So I'm going to end the formal presentation there. If you have any questions or comments, it would be great to hear them.
Is Tonka still in business in Minnesota?
Not in Minnesota. Tonka is no longer a Minnesota company.
Probably absorbed into another
exactly.
Company.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
That game you said, Coody?
Yes.
I have a sister named Audrey.
Uh-huh.
And they call her that now.
Should they call her Cootie?
Yes.
Oh, that's great. Why? Can we ask why?
I didn't know that Cootie was a game. What's the game part of it?
That's what's interesting. People don't realize that there were game rules. Mm-hmm. You spin, and you get to, you know, depending on what you spin, you get to add a part to the Cootie. But yeah, you don't. Yeah, I don't think any of us played the rules.
I think we threw that part away.
Oh yeah, definitely. And that's something that, you know, we've talked about that a number of times. That there are those. Well, Mousetrap was another one. Mousetrap really, if you really followed the rules, it was frustrating and it took forever. You know,
not to mention building the thing.
Yeah, yeah. So it was really much more fun to just kind of play with it. You know, however you could.
Yeah.
I bet that the Star Wars action figures really changed the game as far as the action figures went. I mean, that was when the first of its kind to really show that full encompassing, like, set pieces and all of that.
Exactly. Star Wars was a game changer, and you hit on one of the key reasons, the set pieces. I mean, G.I. Joe in the 60s, when that came out, of course, it had many accessories, too. But Star Wars, because it introduced kids to a whole new world, based in that very popular movie series, it really was. It was a game changer. I don't know if you know this about Star Wars, but it's kind of interesting. Maybe you know this. When they came out, you know, Mego, who was the big action figure company at the time, passed on doing Star Wars, so it went to Kenner instead. So Kenner picked up the contract for making these toys, but was a little blindsided by just how popular the movie turned out to be. So what happened that first Christmas that they were offered was that kids got what was called an early bird certificate. They didn't actually get the toys because they weren't available yet. So kids got for Christmas a certificate, which they then had to wait. But yeah, now the other interesting thing, and you talked about this a little bit earlier too, by that period of time, by the late 70s, we've got the oil embargo going on, which means that plastic is harder to come by, which means that those toys are smaller, right? So the 60s almost foot-high G.I. Joe was a thing of the past, and then the 3-plus-inch Star Wars figure became the standard, and eventually G.I. Joe and everybody followed suit.
What about Mego? Talk a little bit about that company. I mean, they had so many different things on the plate. You know, they passed on Star Wars, but it wasn't that they were suffering for lack of other stuff because they had everything, it seemed like.
Absolutely not. They managed to get the license for, I think, most of the superhero. I mean, Aquaman, just everybody you can think of was a Mego character. And they had the bendability, they had the interchangeable outfits. I mean, they were really the key player. Once, you know, G.I. Joe came in as the first, you know, the first so-called action figure in the mid-60s. But by the end of the 60s and into the 70s, Mego had quickly eclipsed them.
Well, yeah, you had your superheroes, and then you had, like, your celebrities, your Kiss dolls, and your
exactly.
other things.
Yes.
And
yeah.
you had Donnie and Marie. They had all kinds of different things.
You're right about that, yeah. You're absolutely right about that. They managed to stay just one step ahead of every trend that was going on and pick up those licenses and go with them.
Is there any toys on your wish list that you weren't able to find? Or is there a few of the things that are just kind of that diamond in the rough?
That's a really good question. I cannot think of one offhand that we weren't able to find. I can tell you one that got down to the wire. And because it got down to the wire, it didn't even make it into the book. But we were able to find it for the exhibit. And this is a Lionel Train, which, as you know, trains are huge through this period. But what we were looking for everywhere was the Lady Lionel, which was a pastel train, which was, as you can imagine, not very popular. Lionel was looking to boost its sales by coming out, by, you know, moving into the girl market. So how do you do that? Well, you make a pastel train. But, you know, what they didn't calculate, of course, is if a girl is interested in a train, she's going to want a realistic one, not necessarily a pastel one. So we finally, I was looking for one everywhere, and it was actually pretty interesting because we saw a clip online of an antiques roadshow done in St. Paul with a woman who had the train, but we were never actually able to find her. So eventually we borrowed one for the exhibit from the Children's Museum of Indianapolis, but that was one that we almost didn't get. It was more a question, certainly for the book, and maybe for the exhibit too, of just having so many things we couldn't fit in.
What about ventriloquist dummies? they were popular in there in
a lot of time. Along those lines, Glenn, and we've talked before about how when we were kids, it seems like whatever was sort of in our universe, a lot of it came from like garage sales or whatever we could just happen to find. And some of the stuff that we played with wasn't necessarily of our generation. It was older because it was hand-me-down stuff. Mm-hmm. But we had this scary-looking doll, and I don't know where this thing came from. But it had. But I finally figured out just one day, I just stumbled across it online. But it had, it was just the torso and the head. And it had like a hard plastic hollow torso and then like a rubber head, and he was bald. And his name was Hugo. And I found it online. It was called Hugo International Man of Mystery or something like that.
Oh my.
And we were supposed to, we didn't know what it was. We thought it was scary. And it was wearing like a denim button-down shirt. But apparently you were supposed to put little disguises on it.
Really?
With like rubber cement or something, and you know, tape on mustaches and beards and stuff. But I don't know how that thing ever ended up in our orbit, but there it was.
That is funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It must have been, I'm guessing it's from the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s.
And then you had the celebrities putting out dolls and different things.
Yes.
Like the, you know, the Barbies. And for the Barbie, there was a Farrah Fawcett thing. I
yes.
remember the, like Mark was talking about the heads, that they would have these doll heads, these full heads, like my cousins would have, and play with them and brush them and put makeup on them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I think maybe even Farrah Fawcett had something.
I think you might be right about that. Yeah, yeah, you're right. There are the heads, there's the, you know, it got to the point, really, it appeared to us anyway, that every hit TV show eventually had a doll connected with it. I mean, that just became sort of de rigueur in the 70s and certainly going forward.
Back to the Mego thing.
I mean, yes.
They were there to, basically, mm-hmm. if somebody had a show and, you know,
yes.
it was successful enough and marketable enough, you would see a Mego doll.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right.
One thing that I'm just thinking of here that I haven't thought about for a long time was the Light Bright.
Oh,
did anybody
yes.
bring up the Light Bright?
They did.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
The only downer to that was that the Light Bright, it had the little colored pegs, you remember that? And it would light up from behind, and you could make a picture with all these different little colored pegs. But it came with paper cutout, a black paper cutout, and then you punched the things in. Once you punched them in, they were pretty much done.
Yeah. That's funny you should bring that up, because that's actually another category that is just starting to develop now as we talk to people about this topic. The disappointment toy.
Yeah.
And Light Bright, you know, kids loved him, but you're right, there was that sort of, oh, now what do I do?
Yeah.
You know, once I've done it, what can I do more with it? Yeah, and we're starting to hear that story over and over with that toy.
Have you run across what's called Golem Walk?
Is that the doll that flips back and forth? We're talking about the Gollywog doll that she has two heads. Is it that one?
Oh, I never heard of that.
Oh, okay.
No, I just heard of other African American mm-hmm. dolls of some sort.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. If I may be wrong about this, but there's one where there's a head and a head, and then a petticoat, right. So you could turn her and basically have two dolls in one. You flip it this way, her, you know, her petticoat comes down this way, and then you turn it over. Here's the other head with the petticoat heading. And I believe some of those were Gollywog dolls.
I think you start another category, scary toys.
Scary. That would be great for going together.
Inadvertently scary toys.
Which is funny. That's funny you should say that, because we have a toy based on a Red Skelton character that we actually took out of the exhibit because it was a little too scary for people.
Not Freddy the Freeloader, was it?
No, it's another one. It's not. Freddy the Freeloader would be
that
bad
was Red
enough.
Skelton, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes. Yeah.
Another name for toys, Fisher-Price. I mean,
yes.
We have so much. I mean, when I go back to my parents' house, my mom still has some of those old little Fisher-Price toys. And
mm-hmm.
did they really start their run?
Well, you know, they came into their own. Those little people, the Fisher-Price little people, are from the late 50s. And then they, you know, then they just stay and stay and stay and gain in popularity. The interesting thing about Fisher-Price, they're one of the first companies that's really doing serious empirical research on what kids want to play. I mean, they've got kids in laboratories and they're watching them. But that whole, I find the whole topic of educational toys to be really interesting, because some of them, you know, the good for you toys that never really got played with, it, but then there are the Fisher Prices that kids loved and that got played with, and they've stood this test of time. They're interesting.
Yeah. This was an 80s toy, and I think I've mentioned it to Glenn before, but it was in the mid 80s. Fisher Price made a video camera that would record black and white audio, video and audio on an audio cassette tape. And then it would play the cassette at a really fast speed, so like a 60-minute tape would run through in about 5 minutes. But it would record really grainy video. And when I was a kid, I saw this in the paper, and I clipped it out, and I carried that around with me. And I was sure that at Christmas that my grandparents were going to get this for me. And I opened up the box under the Christmas tree, and they had bought, not just for me, but for the whole family, a real VHS video camera.
Oh my gosh.
And so all those years I just wanted to see what this camera was. So as soon as we got the internet, that was the first thing I did on eBay, was I bought the PXL 2000.
That's great.
And it works.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they only made it 1 year.
I've never heard of that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, some independent filmmakers use it now, because it has kind of a strange quality to it.
So you talk about the link between childhood interests and what you end up doing as an adult, too. That's pretty interesting.
And it was always about records and the slide projectors and things like that.
One of my first toys, you talk about things that stay with you and shape the way you live. Mm-hmm. One of my first toys was one of those portable photograph record players.
Oh.
And I would play, like, I grew up more of, less of my kids' records, and I would take some of my mom and dad's 45s, and I would take that thing everywhere. I'd take my sisters and brothers who are older than me, I would take their full Kiss records with me over to neighbors and play the Kiss records for them.
That's great. You know, on your little record player? Oh my gosh.
The ones that they could play the full,
play
the 33 and a third.
You know? That's great.
And I would go, again, going to rummage sales, finding more records. I mean, it just really opened up a lot of my ears and my imagination, bringing along, if it was a plug-in, I was going to play it. And if I didn't have a plug-in, I'd sing in the songs.
That's terrific.
Well, thanks for coming up tonight, you guys.
You're welcome.
Thank you, guys.
You've been listening to Write On, a series of conversations with Minnesota authors, historians, and filmmakers. Today, we featured Kate Roberts, co-author of Toys of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The event was recorded June 24, 2014 at the Thief River Falls Public Library. Photos and audio from this and other Pioneer 90.1 speakers events can be found at radionorthland.org. For Write On, I'm Glenn Broggett.